What is a lighthouse? It is a tower with a bright light at the top, located at an important or dangerous place. The main purpose of a lighthouse is to serve as a navigational aid and to warn of dangerous areas. Welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Illuminating the darkness of current EMS clinical practice with the bright light of science. Here are your hosts, Dr. Jeff Jarvis and Mike Verkest.
Hey everybody, welcome to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. Mike Verkest, along with, of course, Dr. Jeff Jarvis, sitting in Texas, probably sweltering as usual. What's cracking there, homeboy?
Well, Mike, man, I don't really know how to tell you this.
Lay it on me. I'm a big boy.
Texas is not exactly a third world country. I realize that, you know, up in the left coast that y'all may think we are.
In the beautiful Pacific Northwest.
Okay, it is kind of beautiful.
Go ahead.
But you don't have to rub that in my face.
Okay.
No, I was going to just let you know that we do have this thing called air conditioning down here.
Oh, that's true.
It is 72 degrees year round in my house.
Yeah. See, so that's the thing. And speaking of 72 year round, I mean, I guess it is in my house as well, but we have pretty distinct seasons here in Oregon.
You know, you really are going to go for the rubbing it in, aren't you?
Well, I mean, yeah. So we have fall. Fall starts in October, usually right around Halloween. I mean, that's when fall starts for it, regardless of what the calendar say in the first day of fall, whatever.
It's, you know what fall usually, is in Texas? Yeah. It's what happens to the nursing home residents.
Right. Yeah, true. Yeah, I could see that. But it is the most beautiful time of year. If anyone listening ever gets a chance to come to the Northwest, I would tell you the best time of year is going to be right in the middle of October. It is the most beautiful. The leaves are turning. The temperatures are cool. It's those times where you use the heater in the morning and then you turn the air conditioning on in the afternoon. I mean, because you have a big swing of temperatures and it's just, I mean, it's football season's going. I mean, oh God, it is literally the best.
I don't think I like you anymore.
It's so good.
You don't have to come up. I need to. Awesome stuff, man.
Yeah.
Hey, I got a little case for you.
Well, lay it on me.
You want to hear this one?
Okay. I'm ready.
All right. This is not my case. And I will tell you, I just blatantly stole this one from one that was published. But I just got this in my inbox. And this was really cool. So this is a 46-year-old female. It came into the emergency department with right-sided neck discomfort. It had been there for about 5 days. And she said, you know, I think it was just after I fell asleep on a pillow. I just kind of got a crick in my neck. She had taken some over-the-counter medications and not really gotten any better. But then she noticed her right eyelid started seeming a little droopy. So it just wouldn't open up all the way. And that started last night. She now has pain coming down to her right jaw. And she felt a knot on the right side of her neck, just something kind of a bulge there. She went to a chiropractor, had it worked on. She didn't have any fever, chills, no chest pain or shortness of breath, belly pain, weakness, nothing like that. She's really pretty otherwise healthy. Social history, medical history are unremarkable. Her vital signs, she's a little hypertensive. Blood pressure is 190 over 86 on arrival. Heart rate 78, respiratory rate of 18, and her temp is 98. Satin 100% on room air. She doesn't really look toxic. She's not in any distress. But when they do a neuro exam, they see some meiosis and ptosis of the right upper eyelid. So pupils are constricted and she has this little lid lag, or not lid lag, that's something else, lid droop. Otherwise, her cranial nerves are all intact. She's alert and oriented and moving everything she's supposed to. The pupils actually react just fine, just a little bit constricted.
Constricted.
And uneven constricted. So on the right side, it's 2 millimeters. Left is 4 millimeters. So There's not a whole lot of walking through. This is just straight up. Let's talk about what it is. So
good, because I'm sitting here scratching my head, going, "Well, it sounds neurological, or it sounds something's going on in her neck, and it's compressing something." And I don't know. It's just as weird.
Yeah, I think it's brainological.
Yeah,
or neckological. I'm not sure.
Yeah, exactly. Which. Yeah, yeah, one of those.
So, and this you know, it's interesting. We said I'm reading this, and I'm reading it from a newsletter I get from, and I'll just go ahead and tell you, this is who submitted this case, Dr. Brown at Baylor University in Dallas. So I appreciate you sending this case out. That's really cool. So the as I'm going through this, I actually had a case kind of similar to this, but with a different diagnosis, different presentation. So I can't tell you too much about it because it was today, and that's way too close for me to be able to talk about that. Something this unusual. So his differential diagnosis included vertebral artery dissection, cancer, carotid artery dissection, just straight up musculoskeletal strain, which is what it's going to be 99 times out of 100.
Right.
And Horner syndrome. You ever heard about Horner syndrome?
No, Horner makes a damn good harmonica. That's what I can tell you about Horner.
Now that, Mike, is fascinating. I don't suppose they're based in Portland, are they?
No, not at all.
Oh,
not
man,
at
all. See, you should have just brought that right home. That would have been awesome.
That's funny.
All right. So basically, they did some evaluation. One of the things I would be worried about, well, no, I wouldn't, because I was thinking about my case today, so I can't say that. Okay. So they did some CT angiography, and what they ultimately ended up diagnosing was a right internal carotid artery dissection.
Ah, explains the neck pain.
Yeah. So dissection. Those seem bad. Yes. Aortic dissection, you know, ripping, crushing chest pain that radiates down straight below the above and below the diaphragm. Mm-hmm. You may have simultaneous stroke and STEMI. This is about the only thing I can think of that can do that is an aortic dissection. Those are really bad. They go to surgery. Bad. So, and you know, bleeding is a huge problem for them. So what do you suppose the treatment is for a carotid artery dissection?
Is it naloxone?
Nice.
was a throwback to one of our previous podcasts, by the way, if you know that. I feel like
it's not ketamine either, by the way.
No, I figured it probably
wouldn't be. Give it time. We may work our way into ketamine.
We probably will. I mean, I don't know. See, I feel like I want to say something, but I would just look stupid, so I'm not going to say it. So I would rather just hear the actual answer.
Fair enough.
I'll tell you if that's what I was thinking.
So this is a dissection of the carotid artery, so we're going to put them on heparin.
Definitely not what I was thinking.
Exactly. It seems counterintuitive because the last thing you do for an aortic dissection is that. Yeah, so carotid artery dissection, the problem is you get these little clots that flick off. And think about what's downstream from the carotid artery. It's, you know, it's a brain. It's kind of important.
Yeah.
So interesting thing. So the classic thing we think about, we hotty-totty MDs and DOs think about with carotid artery dissection is, well, it's got to be the chiropractor. Some of their hyperactive neck manipulation is known to cause carotid artery dissections. It's pretty rare. But,
oh, geez.
Well, wow. So the other little tidbit is Horner syndrome. So why were we thinking Horner syndrome? So Horner syndrome is this thing you can get from pressure on parts of your nerves. Yeah. The classic board answer is Pancoast tumor. It's a like a cancer. And it's a cancer. It's like a lung cancer or a tumor from lung cancer. But the Horner syndrome is a triad. It's meiosis, ptosis, and anhidrosis. So lack of sweating, and it's on one side only. So that's the reason they were thinking Horner syndrome in this patient. So anytime you see that ptosis along with a constricted pupil, and good luck finding the anhidrosis on just one half of the body, the lack of sweating.
Right.
But anyway, I thought that was, as we were getting ready to record, I read that case and went, man, Dr. Brown, you nailed it. That's a great case.
So I guess the question is, if we were to run on this particular call in the field,
yep,
would we respond code 3 to this patient?
That is an outstanding question. And, you know, you would think, well, of course we do, because we go lights and sirens to everything.
Yeah.
Why
yeah.
wouldn't we? I mean, what's the harm? This is what does the E in EMS stand for, Mike?
Emergency, my brother.
Emergency. The faster. And what is the most important thing? If we're going to measure something about the quality of an EMS system, what's the most important thing we can measure?
Well, everybody knows it's response times.
Everybody knows.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just love that phrase.
And they figured that out at the same time. And you may not know this, mm-hmm. but when they were testing those dogs back in our Epi episode, that's yeah. when they came up with response times. Yeah.
Wouldn't that?
Yeah.
You know, you say that as a joke, but I think you actually may be right. So you're
just as arbitrary.
My career as a firefighter ended in like 1988 as a volunteer firefighter. So when I start talking about firefighting, just don't pay much attention to me. Okay. But you actually have some knowledge of this. When was the big Chicago fire?
Oh God, 1907. Am so I right?
I don't
Something
know.
Like
I,
that?
I truly don't know, but I was thinking. Oh,
I thought you knew
early.
That and you were setting me up. Mm-mm,
no. No, truly, when I'm talking about firefighting, I'm not setting you up. I don't know the answer. But yeah, that's my impression. So, which is pretty close to the Krill and Dooley days. Yes. And I think we get our use of lights and sirens from that, the idea that response times are important, because in the fire service, response times actually can be important because of the rate that a structure catches fire once there's some ignition. So yeah. that's my understanding, that if you're not able to mitigate that fire within, you know, a very short period of time from the time it starts, the entire structure is involved.
Sure. That was 1874, by the way.
Oh, I screwed. Oh, you GTS'd it, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, I GTS'd it.
Okay.
I wasn't going to sit here and not know that.
Okay. Well, that seems important, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, we extrapolated from that, hey, you know, a rapidly burning structure, if you don't get there quickly to stop it from spreading, it's going to be bad. To, yeah. hey, you're having some chest pain. We probably ought to get there as soon as we possibly can. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, 8 minutes or under 9 minutes, 8:59, 90% of the time became the gold standard. And you are a crappy EMS service if you cannot
if you
meet
don't
that,
make that. 90% of the time.
Yeah. And you are the best EMS service if you do.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. But, you know, the good news is what's the downside?
Oh, I don't know.
Just like sirens.
Yeah. I have a feeling you're going to tell us what some of those downsides are.
Well, I don't know. Maybe killing us.
Yeah. Or killing somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Both killing our patient when we are heading back to the hospital.
Yep.
Yeah. So this is one of those, periodically what's going to happen here on the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast is there's going to be something that riles up Dr. Jarvis, and he is going to record about it. And then we're going to come and introduce it, talk about it, and we're going to let him go. And so you may have these periodic podcasts where you're just going to hear him sort of at the main body of it, but you'll hear us sort of introduce it together. So does this really chap your behind, this whole lights and sirens thing?
You know, you might want to say there's a burr under my saddle.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep. It does. It just drives me crazy. Guys, this is how paramedics and EMTs die. It is, we don't need to be doing this. It's something that is just, well, I'll leave the details to science, the discussion that's coming, but yeah, I might have been known when I'm giving a talk on performance measures to go off on a rant about response times and the danger that they cause.
Yeah.
But how about this is a research podcast. How about we hit up some research aspects of this?
All right. That sounds good to me. So I am going to throw it to the virtual you to take us through the Red Lights and Sirens episode of the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast. So we will talk to the real Jeff soon. But in the meantime, we will throw it to virtual Jeff. All right. Thanks, you guys.
All right, y'all. So let's talk about some red lights and sirens. That's what drew everybody into this business. We all got involved in EMS because we want to use the red lights and sirens and drive like a bat out of hell. But the real question is that a good thing? Is it good for our patients? Is it good for the other citizens in the community? And most importantly, is it good for us? And ultimately, what I'd like to do is talk about a paper that came out last year in Annals of Emergency Medicine. As preference to that, what I'd like to do is do a real quick overview of the literature as it existed before that paper came out. And since I've gotten some feedback that I have a tendency to be a little bit verbose, I'm going to break down the prior literature into chunks, and each chunk is going to be designed to answer a specific question. So let's start off by asking why we use red lights and sirens to begin with. Well, I think the relatively straightforward answer is we do it to save time. We want to shorten our response time and get onto the scene as fast as we possibly can, because we know that the faster we get there, the more lives we're going to save. And as always, when I say we all know, that's a pretty good indication that that is probably based more on rumor and mythology than science, but we'll leave the busting of that myth to another time. So what does the science say? The first paper we're going to talk about is by Lawrence Brown, and the title of the paper is Do Warning Lights and Sirens Reduce Ambulance Response Times? This was published in Prehospital Emergency Care in 2000. This was a prospective study out of the Syracuse system. They have run around 40,000 calls a year, and they did a really interesting thing. They would go to a call, lights and sirens, and they would record by independent observer how long it would take them to get to the scene from their starting spot. And then they would go back and duplicate that exact route without lights and sirens and without a patient to see what the delta was between lights and sirens and not. And what they found was, on average, lights and sirens saved 1 minute and 46 seconds. Now, there was a range of time, obviously. The maximum amount of time saved was 7 minutes and 5 seconds faster, but that went all the way up to 3 minutes and 30 seconds slower. So sometimes lights and sirens doesn't save you time. The next paper we want to talk about is out of Portland, Oregon. This is by Rosh Fleischman, and the title is Predicting Ambulance Time of Arrival to the Emergency Department Using Global Positioning Satellites and Google Maps. This was from PEC, Prehospital Emergency Care, in 2013. And the actual thing that we're looking for here was sort of incidental data. The actual paper was validating the use of a Google Map API to predict hospital ETA. I'm assuming someone in the hospital got tired of saying, hey, AMS, they can never get the ETA right, and we're trying to find a more accurate way of doing it. But in the process, they did report time saving with red lights and sirens. And what they noticed is for transport times less than 8.8 minutes, it looks like red lights and sirens saved 3.1 minutes. And for longer transports, and these could have been much longer for all we know, the average time saved was 5 minutes. And that 5 minutes seems to be a lot higher than most of the things that I've noticed. So we have Portland, Oregon, Syracuse, New York. Those are both either urban or urban and suburban systems. Well, how about rural areas? And yes, this next study was by Jeffrey Ho, and the title of the paper is Time Saved with the Use of Emergency Warning Lights and Sirens While Responding to Request for Emergency Medical Aid in Rural Environments. And this also is from PEC 2001. And they found in rural areas, red lights and sirens saved on average 3.6 minutes. So what they did again is they would record with an independent observer what the response time was using red lights and sirens. And then they would go back with a similarly equipped vehicle and do essentially a chase car. They would recreate the same route and at the same time of day and same day of the week and see what that time was without red lights and sirens. And they found, on average, a savings of 31%. So again, that's 3.6 minutes, and that is in a rural area. Well, how about in Greenville, South Carolina, a place with a population of 46,000 and where all the responses in this paper were from inside the city limits? This paper is from Richard Hunt and again our friend Lawrence Brown, and the title is Ambulance Transport Time with Lights and Sirens Faster Than That Without? And this paper was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine way back in 1995. And again, they looked at the South Carolina system in Greenville, and they looked at all transport times with a response time of less than 8 miles or a distance. And they found, on average, 43.5 seconds faster. And they also used an observer on the unit and then a observer in a chase car, following the same routes and obeying all traffic laws. So what we're seeing here is an average, and from the papers we quoted, it looks like a savings of anywhere from 43 seconds to the maximum was 5 minutes for longer transports in Portland. That was a bit out of the norm. Generally, we're seeing somewhere between 1.5 and 3 minutes. Yes, it does look like red lights and sirens saves some amount of time. The question, though, is does that time savings actually improve patient outcomes? Well, according to this study with pretty cool methodology out of New Jersey, that time savings does not result in important patient-oriented outcomes. Now, I use the term patient-oriented outcomes loosely. So let me tell you about this study. This was done by Marquis Baptista. The title is Utilization of Warning Lights and Sirens Based on Hospital Time-Critical Interventions. This was published in Pre-Hospital Disaster Medicine in 2010. This was a retrospective study from one center in New Jersey looking at all of the patients that came into them. And they did it in two parts. Part number one is they determined the time saved using red lights and sirens transporting patients to the hospital versus those without red lights and sirens. And they did the controls in the same way that these other studies did. They used a repeat chase car, if you will, without red lights and sirens to figure out what that time savings was. Then they looked to see if there were time-sensitive procedures performed in the emergency department within the amount of time that was saved from hospital arrival. Now, as an example, if you save 5 minutes using red lights and sirens, was there a time-sensitive procedure done in the emergency department within the first 5 minutes of hospital arrival? So hopefully that makes sense. Now, they defined a time-sensitive procedure as anything that was done in the hospital that could not have been done in the field by paramedics. So they excluded intubation and any of the drugs that paramedics would typically give. Now, the results was, again, in line with what we've seen before, an average of 2.6 minutes were saved. Now, of the 112 patients that they included in this study, five had a procedure done at all. So within any amount of time, they had one of these time-critical procedures that EMS could not do. None of those were done within the first 2.6 minutes of arrival. So their conclusion was that the use of red lights and sirens did not get the patient any procedure done that could not have been done by EMS. And I think this is a really good methodology, because I think fundamentally that is the question. If we're saving time, why are we saving the time? If it's just so that the people in the ER can stare at the patient, then that doesn't really justify a potential risk of using red lights and sirens. Now, if you use red lights and sirens, say 5 minutes, and the patient's chest gets cracked within the first 5 minutes, then theoretically that may be a useful thing, not taking into consideration whether cracking all chest is a useful thing or not. So we said, yeah, it turns out that that time savings doesn't appear to be beneficial. Well, at least in terms of transports to the emergency department. What about using red lights and sirens? Is it harmful to patients? And there does seem to be some evidence that it is harmful to patients, even in the absence of a vehicle crash. And the best example of this is the decreased effectiveness of CPR metrics when transporting a patient using red lights and sirens versus not. And this paper is by Dr. Chung And the title is Effective Vehicle Speed on Quality of Closed Chest Compression During an Ambulance Transport, Resuscitation 2010. And they found that CPR metrics went to hell in a handbasket. Now, the interesting thing is I have done this study in my own system. We have a, this was one of the most fun things that I ever did. We have a vehicle training course that Texas DPS uses, and it's in our county, and we will go out there and we can make use of that track. It's a beautiful track. It looks like a Formula One area with some occasional places to shoot at targets. So it's really cool. And we did a couple of iterations where we would do CPR on a mannequin using CPR feedback devices built into the Philips MRX, and we would compare the quality of CPR in terms of compression rate, compression depth, and pauses based on doing CPR without moving, doing CPR driving code 1, and with CPR driving code 3, and we found about what you would expect. Not moving, the CPR was a little bit better than it was when you were moving, and it was much worse when you're moving with lights and sirens. All right, so taking that, if we're maybe causing some harm because the effectiveness of our interventions that we're doing in a route drops off, that brings to mind the next question, which is, are red lights and sirens associated with increased injury? And there are a couple of papers that say, yes, there are. First paper I want to hit on here is by Saunders, and it is Ambulance Collisions in an Urban Environment. This was from Pre-Hospital Disaster Medicine, 1997, going back to the Wayback Machine. This was a study in San Francisco, and they looked at the rate of injury accidents, looking at red lights and sirens transport versus non-red lights and sirens transport. And they found an overall low rate of injury accidents, but that rate was 1.5 per 100,000 in non-red light and sirens transports versus 22.2 per 100,000 with red lights and sirens. So 1.5 per 100,000 without, 22. So almost a 20-fold increase in injury accidents using red lights and sirens. So that's fairly impressive, I would say. Another study actually uses the NHTSA FARS dataset, or the Fatal Accident Reporting System. This is Kahn et al., and the title of the paper is Characteristics of Fatal Ambulance Crashes in the U.S., an 11-year retrospective analysis, and this was published in Pre-Hospital Emergency Care in 2001. And they looked at overall rates of collision. And actually, one of the things that was interesting about this paper is the amount of data collected in the FARS system. It is truly amazing. But the bottom line is they found that there were more collisions, like 60% more, and more fatalities, 58%, involving EMS use with red lights and sirens. So they compared, of all collisions, how many were involving red lights and sirens versus not. 60% of the collisions occurred while they're using red lights and sirens, and 58% occurred, 58% of the fatalities occurred with red lights and sirens use. And they also further decided that most of those accidents with red lights and sirens occurred at intersections. And that's interesting because intersections are the minority of exposure. Most of the time you spend driving, you're not going through an intersection. Yet the small proportion of time you spend driving through intersections is where the majority of the collisions are. And I think all of us who have driven Code 3 would recognize that that makes sense. That's where you get into trouble. Now, another paper, this one is by McGuire. The title is Occupational Fatalities in EMS, A Hidden Crisis. And I always like titles that say, mention that this crisis, it's out there and it's hidden. This was published in 2002 in Annals of Emergency Medicine, and one of the things that they did was calculated the rate of fatalities among different specialties, if you will. The fatality rate, and these are all per 100,000, so the rate of the general public was 5 per 100,000, EMS was 12.7, firefighters were 14.2, and police officers were 16.5. At least this was the case during 1992 to 1997, that period of time. And I will tell you, my suspicion is that at least firefighter line of duty deaths have decreased since then because most of our fire departments have recognized the value of increased physical fitness and the dangers of heart attacks in extreme environments. So that fitness, those fitness regimens have paid off. So my guess is that is probably a little bit lower. So 74% of all EMS fatalities were during crashes. Interestingly, during that period of time, 11% of them were from assaults. That's kind of a sad thing. So this paper does not particularly break it down by red lights and sirens versus non, but it is a useful marker for the rate at which EMTs and paramedics die. So one other thing that we found from that is that where do paramedics get killed when they're involved in a collision? The odds ratio for death, if you were sitting in the back of the ambulance versus in the front of the ambulance, is 2.7. So 170% higher odds of death when you're involved in a collision if you're in the back of the vehicle versus the front. And my suspicion, anecdotal evidence here, is that it's because we're not restrained in the back of the ambulance, whereas we are in the front. And I think the reason for that is when you're sitting in the front of an ambulance, you're driving, you're sitting in a seat that is specifically designed for that purpose, and it is designed, like the rest of vehicles, to make you safe with a safe restraint system. You can reach all of the controls and do everything you need to do to safely drive with your seatbelt on. In the back of the ambulance, seatbelts are an add-on. It is, I think all of us would recognize, it is exceedingly difficult to take care of your patient in a what the way most of our ambulances are designed while wearing your seatbelt. So next question is this concept of a wake effect. Is there a wake effect? And the definition of a wake effect is a collision caused by the passage of a vehicle using red lights and sirens, but not involving that vehicle. So in other words, the emergency vehicle busts the intersection, red lights and sirens, clears the intersection safely, and then there's a collision after they're out of the way. And this probably has a lot to do with attention of other drivers on the road. So the methodology on this paper isn't all that great, but it does give us some insight into this. This was by Jeff Clausen, he of EMD fame, and it is called The Wake Effect, Emergency Vehicle-Related Collisions. This was published in Prehospital Disaster Medicine in 1997. And Dr. Clausen just did a survey of all of the medics in the Salt Lake City Fire Department as well as Salt Lake County. And they ask the medics, hey, how often have you been involved in a collision versus how often have you seen a collision around you but not involving you when you're going red lights and sirens? And what they found is the average rate of a collision per medic per year is 0.89. However, the average wake effect crash per medic per year is 3.49. So obviously quite a bit higher. And he did some extrapolation, which is extraordinarily dangerous. But that would say if we estimate that there are 6,500 EMS vehicle crashes per year, and we look at that difference between 0.89 and 3.5, there could be 32,000 wake effect crashes. Now, I'm not sure that those numbers are great, so I wouldn't really hang my hat on that. But the concept there is, I think, valid. The use of red lights and sirens has an effect that outstrips the vehicle that is making the noise. Another interesting study comes out of Germany, and it answers the question, is there a physiologic detriment to red lights and sirens use? So this was by Weber. That's my best German accent. That's as good as I can get. Emergency medical transport induces stress in patients with acute coronary syndrome. This was published in Emergency Medical Journal in 2009. And the bottom line is this was a German study of healthy volunteers that were transported both with and without red lights and sirens. And they measured changes in their heart rate, blood pressure, cortisol, and ACTH. And they noticed increases in all of those. And from that, they extrapolated out to a patient having ACS who also has those increases might not do well. All right. So that, I think, is a summation of the background of the information leading us up to our paper. So that paper is titled, Is the Use of Warning Lights and Sirens Associated with Increased Risk of Ambulance Crashes? A Contemporary Analysis Using National EMS Information System Data. Now, this is an interesting paper to me because I know several of the authors, and I very much want to do a similar project with some of them. So this was by Brooke Watanabe, James Kempema, Lawrence Brown, and a couple of other folks. And sadly for them, I don't know them, so I'll skip over their names. James is the medical director of Starflight and the Travis County EMS systems, and Lawrence Brown is a researcher and paramedic, PhD paramedic at the University of Texas at Austin. And they're also associated with the emergency medical residency program there. So the background for this paper, and we'll just discuss this paper like we do all papers, the background here is that red lights and sirens potentially saves time. We've sort of discussed that on average, we're looking at about 2.5 minutes. Red lights and sirens may increase risk both to patients, caregivers, and other people on the road. And it is unclear what association there is between red lights and sirens and crashes. Although there is some evidence, there is not a really good systematic study using national data. So their null hypothesis is that there is no difference in the rate of crashes in either response or transport mode between those with and without red lights and sirens use. So their methods, this is a retrospective cohort study. In other words, they have a great big data set and they just went back and looked at this data set. It's a cohort study because it's looking at a group of people that happen to be represented in this data set. So the population, they are looking at the 2016 public release NMSIS research data set, which is a really cool way of looking at data. And by the way, if you heard that, that means that the Raptors are beating the Warriors 88-81 in the start of the fourth quarter. So I'm sure everybody wanted to know that. I just wanted a little timestamp on there. And since my Rockets are no longer in the playoffs and the Spurs, well, let's not even talk about the Spurs. I don't really much care. So the population was the 2016 public release data set. So this data set, NMSIS, makes this data set available for people who want to do research. They lock it down at the end of a year, and then everyone doing research from the 2016 data set is looking at the same data set. And if you're actually doing analysis on data that's not a public release thing, you'll understand the frustrations that led to this kind of concept. When everyone is using a slightly different data set, it gets very frustrating. So this in 2016, the NMSIS data set, just to give you an idea of the scope, it covered 30 million EMS activations by 9,993 unique EMS agencies in 49 states or territories. So this is a huge data set. This is the largest EMS data set around. Their inclusion criteria were all dispatches of transport-capable vehicles to a 911 call with a ground transport, or I'm sorry, a ground response. So their exclusion criteria were interfacility transfers, intercepts, meaning you're dispatched to intercept another vehicle, medical transports, and I'm assuming what they mean by this are like the dialysis runs or taking patients to home or back to the nursing home from the hospital. They also excluded standbys, supervisor runs, or assist calls, as we call them in our system, non-transport unit responses, so your first responder agencies are excluded from this, anything that is not from a transport unit, and then any rotor or fixed wing is excluded from this. So they obviously have different methods of response and transport, and lights and sirens on a helicopter probably isn't going to do a whole lot of good. The outcome they were interested in was crash-related delay. Now, it's sort of interesting how they defined this. They defined a crash-related delay because in the NMSIS dataset, there is a field that says what was the response delay and or transport delay. Now, they have several options. One of them is a great big train parked between you and the road that you need to drive on. But one of those delays is crash-related. So that was their main outcome, crash-related delay. And they used a couple of definitions for red lights and sirens. Again, going back to the NMSA's data set, the NMSA standards give you several options for documenting red lights and sirens. So one is just red lights and sirens emergency response. One is non-red lights and sirens upgraded to lights and sirens, or lights and sirens initially downgraded to non-lights and sirens, or then just no lights and sirens at all. And based on those options, they came up with three groups: either full lights and sirens, which means that throughout either the response mode or the transport mode, you had lights and sirens on the entire time; any use of lights and sirens, which includes the upgrades and downgrades; and then no lights and sirens. Now, they used their primary analysis was full lights and sirens versus no lights and sirens, but they used the any lights and sirens as part of a sensitivity analysis to see whether that made a difference. And flash forward, it did not. They also did the same thing with the very small number of responses that did not have lights and sirens use reported. And that also in the sensitivity analysis made no difference. So what do we know about the analysis? First, I have to say it was done in STATA. And as much as I should be promoting STATA, since it's headquartered in College Station, I'm kind of an R guy, so I have to frown on that. The main thing they did was an analysis of crashes as a function of response mode. And they did do some adjustments in their analysis. They looked at agency run volume, and they broke that into quintiles. They looked at time of day, service level, or service level meaning like ALS or BLS or paramedic or MSU or MD, RN, that type of thing. Organization type, and the categories within the NMSA's data set here are fire department, government-based service, community nonprofit agency, hospital-based systems, and private non-hospital-based systems. And they looked at what is essentially employment status, so volunteer, mixed, or non-volunteer. And then NMSIS also has a field for urban city, which is an indication of whether this is urban, suburban, rural, frontier. So ultimately, they ended up calculating an adjusted odds ratio with a 95% confidence interval. And they also calculated what the overall rates were and the difference in rate between lights and sirens and non-lights and sirens. And they stratified this analysis out between the response phase and the transport phase. And I think that's probably a very useful thing. All right. So drumroll, please. What did they find? Well, I'm going to discuss discuss these results by table. And there were some interesting things in table two. And table two was the agency characteristics and the run characteristics and lights and sirens use among different response and transport modes. So basically, for example, they said, does the quintile of response volume, does response volume make a difference? And then they would just say for the, you know, lowest 20% call volume, of which there are like 4 million calls, what was the response lights and sirens use or the non-lights and sirens use? And there was no difference. When they get to agency level, however, service level, the higher the service level, the lower the use of red lights and sirens during transport mode. There wasn't a real clear distinction in response mode. And that kind of makes sense. You go to the scene based on the information you get from your dispatchers. So your skill level doesn't really matter much. However, once you get there, perhaps let's say as a basic EMT, you may not have the ability to control an airway. So you may be more likely to go lights and sirens use rather than a physician or a paramedic who can do something about it. And they lumped physician groups in with paramedic. They looked at agency type, and interestingly, fire departments had the highest rate of red lights and sirens use during both response and transports. Volunteers had the highest rate of red lights and sirens transport use, which was sort of interesting. The lowest rate for both groups was non-volunteers, in other words, paid people. All right, well, let's get, they looked at time of day, and that did not have, there was no difference based on time of day. So that's kind of interesting. All right. So what was the bottom line takeaway? So the odds ratio for any lights and sirens, what is the odds ratio for a crash-related delay with any lights and sirens use? And it was 1.18, and that is a significant number. So the confidence interval, the unadjusted, was 1.01 to 1.37. Overall odds ratio, 18% higher odds of a vehicle or a crash-related delay using lights and sirens. If you factor in those adjustments that we talked about, it is a 50% higher odds, adjusted odds ratio of 1.5. Full use of lights and sirens, which means that you are there the entire time, the adjusted odds ratio was 1.53, roughly the same, 53% higher. Now, if you look, now this is really interesting. So that was going to the scene, roughly 50% higher odds of a crash-related delay with the use of lights and sirens. They also looked at this with transport, and what they found is an odds ratio. So let's start with full use of lights and sirens. So they were lights and sirens the entire way. The odds ratio, adjusted odds ratio for a collision was 2.84. So a 184% higher odds of a crash using lights and sirens to the hospital. Any use of lights and sirens, roughly the same, 2.9. So why might this be different? Why might the crashes be more likely going to the hospital than to the scene? Well, the paper, they did a pretty good job of coming up with some possible reasons. One reason is that you know what the patient looks like, and perhaps the severity of the patient is such that everybody's catecholamines are way higher, including the person operating the vehicle, and therefore they might be more likely to take more risk and drive faster and perhaps be more reckless. Certainly of the experienced providers I know, I'm not so sure that that is a significant level. I think it would definitely, looking at my experience, when I was brand new doing this, when I was a 19-year-old driving an ambulance for the first time, absolutely that would have applied to me. But as a 50-year-old paramedic, when I drive an ambulance, I try very specifically not to let that affect me. Because I recognize that if we get run over by a freight train, it's not going to help the patient very much. So another hypothesis they came up with, and I find this one much more compelling, is going to the scene. Typically, you have you and your partner up front. So as I'm busting an intersection, my partner is helping me clear that intersection. Also, as I'm driving, my partner is taking care of radio traffic and messing with the CAD with printouts on the CAD that is way too small for my 50-year-old eyes to see. However, when I'm driving to the hospital, I don't have my partner up there anymore, so I'm having to do all of that, and there might be more distractions. So I think those are pretty reasonable guesses as to why this is very clearly more likely to have a lights and sirens induced crash going to the hospital. All right. So what is my bottom line summary? Red light and sirens use is definitely associated with crashes. I think this is about as good data as we're going to get, because no one is going to do a randomized control trial on this. I just don't think that is an ethical study. So bottom line, if red lights and sirens use has minimal benefit, it has a real harm, maybe small, but it's still real, we should try to limit our red lights and sirens responses to only those cases where there may be some actual benefit. And here, I think we have some additional work to do. What are, let's say you're using a priority dispatch system, what are the call determinants that are associated with life-saving interventions by the medic within the amount of time that would be saved by using lights and sirens? That's a great question, Jeff. Perhaps we should look into that. Well, thank you, Jeff. I believe we will. All right, so that's my takeaway on this. Bottom line, as they said in Hill Street Blues, y'all be careful out there.
You've been listening to the EMS Lighthouse Project podcast, a proud member of the FlightBridge Ed podcast family and a Fire Dog production. Visit flightbridgeed.com for more information.